and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Alaska pilots Dick Reeve, Chuck Cicera, Warren Polsky, Bill English, and Ron Sheardown. The Old and Bold Pilot Storytelling event was jointly hosted by the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum and Alaska Public Media. It was recorded May 14th. This talk was shortened for broadcast. Our first speaker is Alaska pilot Dick Reeve.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I guess I'm starting off because we really don't have any instructions about what we're precisely supposed to talk about. On that basis, last night I sat down and tried to figure out what I was going to talk about and went through my whole life. Started in Seward in 1837, first airplane ride in a Fairchild 71 in 6 weeks later, and so forth and so on. By the time I got to 1985, 45 minutes had passed, and I thought this is not going to fit into 20 minutes. Sherry announced that the FAA is not invited tonight, and I don't care because this is a statute of limitations story. Sometime in the early 60s, I was actually flying for a living for Revolution Airways, of course. I was co-pilot on a DC-3, and one of our routes that we flew with that airplane was a 3-day trip that went from Anchorage through a whole bunch of points in the Aleutians all the way out to Nikolsky, about 900 miles from here, and then turned around and came back. It was scheduled as a 3-day trip. Sometime it took us as many as 4 and 7. On one particular trip, things been going very well. The weather was magnificent. In fact, there's no wind anywhere on the chain. The sun was shining. The temperatures were really warm for the Aleutians in the Alaska Peninsula. They were almost at the international standard temperature of 59 degrees Fahrenheit. DC-3 generally operated in and out of short fields. They're dew line strips, 3,500 feet long, to be completely gross, legal, and so forth and so on, you needed a little bit over 4,000 feet. But we were quite used to operating in and out 3,500 feet. And on the return leg, it was generally the co-pilot's job to fly, so I got to sit in the left-hand seat. As we proceeded from Nikolsky out at the far end of the route through Umnak and through Driftwood Bay and through Dutch Harbor and Cape Sarachef, we arrived Cold Bay. We had about two or three passengers, which is about two or three passengers more than we'd ever carried on that route. And the next stops were Sandpoint, Port Moeller, Port Hyden, and then on into Anchorage. Sandpoint, the airplane got pretty full. Meanwhile, back in Cold Bay, standing on the ramp waiting to fly with us back to Anchorage was a retired Northwest Airlines captain whose name was Joe Orbeck. Joe was a wise old man. His retiring flight was in a Boeing Stratocruiser. And since he was age 60 and out of work, he went to the FAA and says, "You put me out of the job, so you better hire me so I can finish off my working career." So he's out at Cold Bay, gets on the airplane. And my captain on that trip was Grant Forsyth, and I neglected to mention that the night before at Umnak, Cape Air Force Base, during World War II, there were a couple of pallets full of fire brick for one of the boilers out there. I had a new place down in Alyeska and needed some fire grip brick to put down as the hearth in fireplace. So loaded up the front baggage cage, and it looked like it was about 1,200 pounds. And getting back now to our departure from Sandpoint, we were pretty much at Gross with full tanks and so forth. Got to Port Moeller, which was weight restricted to somewhere around 22 or 23,000 pounds, and we were pushing 28 or 29,000. And started rolling down the runway, and I'd never flown hot and heavy before. And we rolled, rolled, and rolled, and the airplane rolled off the end of the runway into the air. And I called for gear up, and Grant, the captain, leaned over. He was, as he was reaching for the landing gear lever, he says, "Flies like a ton of bricks, doesn't it?" Almost crashed. So perfectly apropos. So having passed that hurdle and learned something new that very day, we made it back into Anchorage on the third day of the three-day scheduled trip. So all in all, it was pretty good. That's my story for the time. Does anyone have any questions?
A member of the audience asks how long those routes would take now with new aircraft and new technology.
Well, you can't because half the runways are closed and gone. The dew line was that. But let's see, it would generally take us 8 flying hours to get from Anchorage to Nikolsky. And with the DC-3, it used to take just about 8 flying hours with only 2 fuel stops to get to ADAC. Shemya was a 3-day trip because we would have flown about 24 hours making a round trip to the end of the chain. The last airplanes we operated were the Boeing 727. And it was a 7-hour trip.
Another member of the audience asks if Dick has any stories about flying with SEALs from the Pribilofs.
Yes. Let's see. We Pribilof Islands, home of the northern fur seal within the United States boundaries. It was a substantial breeding colony of millions of the northern fur seal. Got conned into operating a tourist operation there during the summer. And so my father chose to headline his ad, "Come see romance in full bloom." But yes, we would haul seal amongst other critters back and forth to science labs and so forth. The one that probably was most memorable for me was the first sea otters to come out of Amchitka Island in the early 60s, or in fact, perhaps even the late 1950s. That was when Sea Otter Jones was operating his skiff out between ADAC and ATU and so forth and so on. And we ended up with a bunch of cages of sea otter in the passenger compartment of the DC-4, which is cargo, people, whatever we could fit in there. Well, sea otters did not really appreciate any high altitude at all. So they began wailing, and they became very upset and very messy, and they stank, too. We landed at Cole Bay because the Sea Otter Jones had called ahead that it was time to feed the sea otters. This being probably July of that year, we were met at the airplane with buckets full of fish that the sea otters just heartily devoured. And on the rest of the trip to Anchorage, they digested and divested of the rest of the fish.
And lastly, someone asks, which aircraft did you enjoy flying the most?
I liked a lot of airplanes. My favorite airplane that I spent almost the most time in was the Curtiss C-46. the World War II cargo carrier. It flew the hump in Asia, did resupply everywhere. It was a big airplane, weighed 30,000 pounds empty, 50,000 pounds with payload and fuel. You sat up just about as high as you could in an airplane so you could survey the world through huge panels of glass all over the cockpit, but it still flew like a Piper Cub. And spent a whole bunch of time flying that thing at 200 feet on instruments, IFR, out over the Bering Sea between points in the Aleutians. Just a stable, excellent airplane, and even climbed Mount McKinley in it once.
The next speaker is Alaska pilot Chuck Cicera.
My dad used to work for the CAA, and then later the FAA from time to time. And one of the things he did was work out on the chain. So he used to ride with Reeves all the way out to Chemy and ADAC and stuff. One time he got ready to come back into Anchorage, and they were flying in they had a DC-4. Did you have a DC? Yeah, DC-4. And they had a cargo in the front, so when you crash, the cargo kills the pilot, the co-pilot, but doesn't hurt the passengers. And then there was an empty space where they put baggage and odds and ends, and then the paying passengers, or whatever kind of passengers they were, sat way in the back, as far back as they could get in the airplane. So there was an empty place between where the passengers were actually sitting and this pile of cargo in the front. So it was blowing like hell, foggy as could be. They couldn't see 15 feet. My dad and all a bunch of these electricians were going back to Anchorage, going out and got on the airplane. They pull out on a runway. The engines were roaring. My dad almost immediately got out of his seat and shook a blanket out on the floor and started a 4-5-6 game. They started gambling. And they're busy gambling. First hour goes by, hour and a half goes by, they're gambling. Man, they're having a hell of a good time. June walks up. My dad says to June, "June, when are we going to be in Anchorage?" She says, "I don't know. We haven't left the ground yet." He was probably flying the airplane. I got to tell you one more thing about me and Reeves. My brother worked for an investment firm, and they had an office in downtown Anchorage, and they actually rented the space from Reeves, who had the bottom floor, and my brother was up on top floor. And every time I'd go in to see my brother, I'd have to pass his dad. Well, I was a Democrat, and Tilly Reeves was a national committee woman for the Republican Party. So I walked very lightly when I walked by his dad, and he'd always go around me, and I looked at him. I was scared to death of him, you know. And one day he stopped me and he said, "You've got to, I want to talk to you." I said, "Oh, brother." So I go over there and I sit down on the very front edge of my chair, ready to break and run. He looks at me like this, you know. I describe him in my book as a steely-eyed risk taker. That's his double right there. But anyway, he's growling at me, and I'm just sitting there shaking my boots. I don't know what he's got in store for me. And he reaches in his desk and pulls his desk open, drawer open, grabs a book. It's Glacier Pilot, the book about Bob Reeves, already signed to Chuck Cicera. I go, whew. He says, "I got you, didn't I?" I said, you sure as shit did. Scared the bejesus out of me. The other thing I say about Reeves is, I was flying around, you know, kind of limping around trying to learn how to fly. I had a license, but that doesn't mean you know how to fly. So your chief pilot, Big Bill Borland, got a hold of me and he says, "Chuck, let's you and I get in that T-craft and go fly around a little bit. I'm going to show you how to stay alive." Well, Bill Borland must have made about 280. I weighed 220. And we used to get my T-craft on floats. Then we put in about 30 or 40 pounds of food because he had to have something to eat along the way, you know. And we would fly and fly and fly. We had a good time. He really did teach me how to stay alive. He taught me a lot of tricks that kept me alive. But anyway, he told me point blank, he said, "Chuck, I hold the world's unchallenged record for 180-degree turns." and I want you to be number two. I said, you got that. So part of my career has been survival, and I don't have any real good stories about wiping wings off of on trees, cartwheeling car airplanes into ditches. I did put a C-46 down with full load on it, with both engines dead, squeezed it into a little farmer's field, and we repaired it and got it out of there. That was my first time I was in the airplane, and I was in the left seat. I owned it, so I just said, hell with it, I flew it. But like he said, a good airplane. But anyway, where was I going with this whole story? Oh, I know. Everybody wants to know what your favorite airplane. Well, I don't know that I have a favorite airplane. I've flown 171 different models of airplanes. That's all the way from home-built Breezy up to a Lockheed Constellation. And a lot of stuff in between you never heard of. So I've had a great aviation career. As far as I'm concerned, I've had a good time. Never made any money, but I had a hell of a good time. And, that sounds like a good engine out there. I hear a big old lumping round engine talking to us outside. By the way, my wife loved any kind of airplane if it had a round engine. She had good judgment. She liked Beavers. She liked 195s. She loved those big round engines. But anyway, here's a story for you. I was working in Anchorage. My dad was down on the chain somewhere. My wife was in Los Angeles with my son Charlie, who's sitting in front here, showing him off to his grandparents. So my mother was out at Big Lake at our lodge by herself. This is in the early 60s, probably 60. No, 50s, late 50s. So I was working in Anchorage. So I got off on Friday night and I drove back up to Big Lake. I walked into the lodge. My mother was in there. I said, hi, Mom. How are you doing? Okay. Did you have a nice week? She said, yeah. Pretty nice week. I said, oh, that's cool. She's, well, it was kind of interesting. I said, what was interesting? She says, I bought an airplane. I said, you bought an airplane? Yeah. I said, what kind is it? She said, I don't know. You don't know what kind of airplane? But no, but Jack Peck sold it to me. He says, a good airplane. It's got everything new. It's big. It's beautiful. Roomy. Nice. And you can get it. You can pick it up tomorrow at Lake Hood. I was beside myself. I couldn't sleep that night because I didn't know what kind of airplane she bought, but that was an airplane. So and I know at that point I had probably 300 or 400 hours in a little two-place airplanes. So I drove into town early in the morning. Where did I arrive? Right here. This is where Alaska Aeronautical Industries was sitting. No airplane here around here looked like the one I was supposed to own. So finally I go in the hangar, and there it was sitting in the hangar. It was absolutely stunningly beautiful. It was an Aronca sedan with a zero-time engine, a new propeller, new paint job, new fabric on the fuselage, new interior, new glass, new tailwheel. No radio, of course, but everything was new. I couldn't believe my mother bought that airplane, $3,900. And she financed half of it, which meant I had to get a land plane rating because I seaplane rating only because I'd been flying seaplanes all the time. So I go beside myself. I go over and I hug and kiss Jack Peck. Now you can believe that one if you want to. And Herb Mensing. And they push it. It's on 2,500 West Coast skis. They push it out of the hangar. What did I do now? Turn it off? No, okay. Anyway, they push it out of the hangar. I'm talking about right here. You know this little bluff here that go down to the water? We shoved it out there. I got in it. Hit the starter button. Ah, smooth six-cylinder engine running. I said, oh, wow, is that nice? I look over at the towers, old wooden tower set over here on the edge of the lake. I looked up, and the guy goes, with the green light, give me a green light to taxi. So I poured a little power to it, kicked the rudder, and slid down off this bank, down onto the ice. And I taxied over to the west end of the lake and turned around and faced the tower. He gave me a light, green light. I put the power in nice and smooth, and the thing started going. tail lifted off, smooth as silk. We climb up, go up to 950 feet. I pull the power back, and I land at Merrill Field. Slide to a stop in front of the FAA office. I get out of the airplane, take one last look at it as I turn and walk, go into the office. I walk in there and I say, he said, what do you need? And I said, well, I'd like to get a land plane endorsement, a land plane rating. Okay, so I filled out the paperwork and a guy named Gruber was gonna give me the ride. So I'm looking at him and we go out to the airplane. Well, we had to do a walk around, careful. In those days, we used to actually open the cowling for you new pilots, open the cowling and grab the plug wires to see if they were actually fastened to the plugs. Grab the exhaust system and make sure it was tight. You know, really do a pre-flight. Today, you can't even see the damn engine you're gonna run. But anyway, I went through all this very carefully to make sure that I didn't make any mistakes with this guy watching me. We get in the airplane, we fire the engine up. I turn and I face the tower. I kick the rudder, pull the airplane around, face the tower. And just before they gave me the green light, the guy says to me, how much time do you have in this airplane? I said, 5, maybe 6 minutes. In today's world of aviation, they need 15 or 20 hours before they turn somebody loose, you know, and then they don't know how to fly. But anyway, I took that airplane out and I started flying it. And it didn't have any radio in it, none. No kind of a radio, no receiver, no nothing. And I flew it for 600 hours all over the state, down the chain, up north, all over, back, forth, here, there, and everywhere. And I learned how to navigate, dead reckoning navigation. And why I mention this, and I told the same story, by the way, to a group that was here when Bill English got his reward the other day. But later years, I was flying really wore out, beat up, trashy, engine failing, leaking oil, Lockheed Constellation out of Miami, going south down and all the way to Brazil. And I dead reckoned my way across the water, then across the Mato Grosso, over miles and miles and miles of green, with no airstrips, no roads, no riverbeds, no sandbars like you got in Alaska, just green for 1,000 miles to a little tiny village. Take off, come back to Miami, and have to find an island out in the middle of the Caribbean to get fuel, because we had to have 145-octane fuel in that airplane. And it was a stasho on an island called Isla San Andreas. It belongs to Colombia. And I would nail that island from 800, 900 miles out to sea to pick it up. Using what? The same techniques that I learned in the Aranca sedan that Jack Peck had sold me many years before. Any questions?
A member of the audience asks Chuck when his book is coming out.
Well, it's in the works. We're doing the final editing now. In fact, I talked to the editor yesterday, and we think we're within about a week of being done with that portion of it. And then we're going to do a little bit of final tuning on it. And we've got about 55 pictures. We're going to pick out the pictures and then write captions for them. So the whole process takes time, but we should be able to produce a book sometime before the first of the year. And it's going to get launched right here at this museum. Our national launching is going to be right here.
Someone else asks about the title of the book.
The title of the book is Please Don't Scare the Pilot. Now, where that came from was this. I was in a Cessna 180. When I write the story in my book, it's an old 91303 sat on the edge of the Kuskokwim River in Bethel. It was a tired old Cessna 180 with very leaky floats, worn out engine. Nobody wanted to fly it. It was always the last airplane to leave the ground. And my pilots, you know, they were flying new 185s and things like that, not that old junker. So I was chief pilot and owner. So oftentimes, poor 91303 and I were stuck with each other. So it was a trip come up. I had to go out to Scammon Bay and pick up a young Eskimo girl who I knew had flown before. before, and her boyfriend and some federal bureaucrat with a required briefcase. So I landed out at Scammon Bay, picked them up, pumped the floats out one more time, got in the airplane, fired up, took off, went rolling out over the water, climbed up. Everything was going pretty well. I got to about 1,500, 2,000 feet, and I'm out over the water, starting to make a turn to come back this way towards Bethel, when the engine blew up and oil went all over the windscreen. I mean, a pile of oil went over it. I couldn't see forward. I'm looking out the side of the airplane, looking down at the water because I got to land on top of the swells. The swell is running like this, and I've got to land right on top of it and stay there so I don't slap the wings on the water. He says to me, he taps me on the shoulder and says, "Are we going to die?" And I said, "No." "Well, I'm not going to. I don't know about you." But anyway, and I pointed to a sign that one of my pilots had put on the dashboard. It was one of those label maker signs. We had a lot of empty space on the our airplanes because we didn't bother putting radios and all the other clutter in there. So we had a lot of empty panels. So this guy made a little label maker sign that said, "Please don't scare the pilot." Since we didn't have right-hand controls in the airplane or pedals or anything, we could carry cargo and people in the right-hand side without them bothering us. So I pointed to that sign as we landed in the water. And then we taxied back. It took me 4 hours to taxi back around to Hooper Bay just with the engine just idling. And I'd have to get out of the airplane, climb out, shut the engine off, get out, take the pump, go pump the floats out, walk on the wire between the two floats, across, holding on the propeller with a pump in one hand, round to the other side, pump that side out, then walk back and walk across the wire, then get back in the airplane and start the engine. In the meantime, my passengers would say, 10, 9, 8 and a half. They were scoring me like I was a gymnastic act. It took us 4 hours to get back. Anyway, that was old 91303, and it had a dashboard sign, and it's in my book, by the way. Please don't scare the pilot. And I said to myself, if I ever write a damn book, it's going to be named Please Don't Scare the Pilot.
All right.
Okay? Thank you.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Alaska pilots who told their stories at the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum on May 14th. You were just hearing from Chuck Cicera. Our next speaker is Warren Polsky, who's here to tell a story about rescuing our last speaker, Chuck.
Well, I'm Warren Polsky, and I've been here, grew up in Anchorage, spent most of my life here, and got into flying at a very early age because I was like 6 years old when World War II started, and I was a frustrated fighter pilot. And anyway, I got my license in 51, and I flew up until 2 years ago actively. And I spent 50 plus years with the CAP and have probably flown around 8,000 hours search and rescue and evacuations and everything over the years for CAP. And flew every airplane they had over the years. And I was chief check pilot for CAP for a number of years. Anyway, my story is about Chuck Cicera. And Dick Reeve. Anyway, in 76, January 76, Chuck crashed over in Chickachamna Lake on his way in from Bethel. He made a crash landing over there, and of course everybody survived. Well, we took off on the 17th of January to look for him. And I had Chuck's younger brother, Dick, with me, and one of the fellows from CAP. And we were flying a Cessna 310. Well, the weather wasn't what you would call conducive to searching, because I got up into Chickachamna Lake, and it was, you know, just low visibility, and I was between layers most of the time, and we flew right by them. Never did see him because it was just flat light. Well, I got through Merrill Pass okay, and after looking around, the weather was coming down pretty fast, and I got over to Whitefish Lake, and I said, well, let's go into Sparavon for a little bit. So we landed at Sparavon, and the story about Sparavon is you don't stop there for coffee because you're going to be there. Well, as it turned out, Reeve came in there with a C-46 with a load of fuel. And I was at the head of the runway getting ready to take off when they called in, so I couldn't go. And the weather was coming down pretty fast because I couldn't even see the far end of the runway. And so anyway, the 46 landed, and I was blocked in, and I couldn't leave. So finally, we took about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, before they got all the fuel off the airplane, off that 46. Well, he had to leave before I could, and so he took off, and he called me back. He was passing through 14,000 feet in heavy ice. And they didn't break out. They went to 16,000 and never did get out of the clouds. And I only had, on 310, I only had 30 minutes of alcohol for the props. So I knew I couldn't go anywhere. So I turned around and parked the airplane. Well, we stayed at Sparavon for 3 days, and this CAP fellow that was with us had a nervous breakdown. He just went to pieces. Well, the Air Force called, and they got a C-130 in there. So 3 days later, I turned the numbers from a 310 to a 130, and I came back to Elmendorf. And we took off from Sparavon and went into the clouds about halfway down the runway. We didn't break out again until we were on final approach at Elmendorf. So that's the way the weather was. Well, in the meantime, they had found Chuck, and he was back in Anchorage. Well, we're sitting in Sparavon. So through the period of about 3 weeks, the weather was continually lousy in January over in that part of the country. And finally, after about 3 weeks, the weather picked up enough for us to go over and retrieve the airplane. Well, I get to Sparavon, and they wanted me to stay a little while. They had a presentation to make. And like I said, Chuck and nobody was hurt, so it was a fortunate. Small envelopes. What? There's always another way to open an envelope. Anyway, the presentation they made me at Sparavon is a certificate of survival. And it reads, to all who shall hear these presents, greetings to all who shall read this presents. In accordance with and in pursuit to directives hereunto contained upon and established by AF Form 899, and in the ever-present face and defiance of such options of forbidden dangers such as wayward-eating werewolves, rapid foxes, hordes of ravaging, starving mosquitoes, careless caribou herds, ugly moose, and brawny bears, not to mention an occasional wandering wolf. In addition, two tremendous mountain roads, screaming windstorms, red chill factors, thin ice, whiteouts, blackouts, fadeouts, but no way out. This is a certificate of survival awarded to Warren Polsky for having successfully completed a period of 3 days at remote Arctic ice outpost Sperrvon Air Force Station. Herefore, henceforth, and hereto, he is awarded the title of survivor. And it was signed by the base commander and the first sergeant. But anyway, the reason we got out of there was, like I said, the fellow that was with us was having a nervous breakdown, and they managed to get a Herc in there to get us out. And by the time we got back to Anchorage, of course, Chuck had been back there for a couple days, I think. Anyway, we had gone right by him, but like I say, the weather was so bad and so flat light that we never did see him. And it was a miracle we got through Merrill Pass. It just was open long enough that I got on through it and got over to the other side. And once we landed there at Sperrvon, that was it. I mean, there was no place for us to go. And every day, Northern Consolidated had a flight that went to Bethel. And they came over at 10:30 in the morning, and every morning I'd talk to the guys, how's the weather? Well, lots of it, we're at 16,000 feet and still in it, you know. So there was nowhere I could go. I thought about trying to sneak out the back door and going up to McGrath, but the weather was lousy all over the place. And it was just one of them things, you know. And basically, in all the flying I've done, that was one of the two times I actually wasn't able to get home. And I've flown in some lousy weather over the years. And one of the other stories I kind of like to talk about, when the earthquake hit, well, of course, the CAP, back in those days, the CAP was the first responder to everything, any kind of disaster, aircraft accidents, missing airplanes, or what. We didn't have a paid state trooper Air Force back then. We didn't have the 210th Air Rescue and the 212th Air Rescue, which are all paid people like that now. Nowadays, you know, they're the ones that go out and do all the stuff. Back then, it was all volunteer. And when the earthquake hit, the CAP flew the largest airlift next to the Berlin airlift in civilian times. We flew the equivalent of 2.5 times around the world in 63 days. And myself, I flew 286 hours in that 63 days, and the only reason I didn't make 300 hours is I wound up in the hospital with fatigue for 3 days. So that's short of me, but I was the first one to go into Valdez after the quake with an airplane. And all I can say, what Valdez looked like when I went down the arm and looked towards the town, was if you've ever seen a picture of Hiroshima, that was it. And so I made quite a few trips in and out of Valdez over the time. But the most memorable one I have was I got sent over there on a medical evac. When the earthquake hit, there was a young doctor in Valdez, excuse me, and he put his tail between his legs and he was out of there immediately. And Dr. White, who had been, he was in his 90s, and his wife, Mary, they were both in their 90s. And they'd been retired for years while he went to work right away, you know, and she was an invalid. Well, anyway, he called and wanted her brought to Anchorage to be hospitalized. So I went down there to get her. They brought this woman out in an ambulance, and she was on a gurney. And she was cussing like a drunken sailor, you know, I ain't going nowhere with nobody and no damn airplane. And so I walked over to her, and I said, "Hi, Mary, I'm Warren Polsky." She says, "Oh, I know you, I'll go with you." And so we loaded her up in the Beaver, and I brought her to Anchorage, and from there I lost track of her. So that was one of the best stories I had to tell about all the things that, from the earthquake. I did a lot of stuff that shouldn't have been done, but was done back in those days. Nobody paid any attention. You just did it. And we had longshoremen loading the airplanes, believe it or not. And of course, longshoremen, you know, if there's a hole, you fill it up. Well, one time I had a flight to Seward, and I was taking Mrs. Darling back down with me. And I should have realized, you know, about the time I went by the old FAA building and the tail was still on the ground, there was something wrong with this. Well, I finally staggered off into the air, and that's when they were first pushing Fifth Avenue through, and I kind of slid over to Fifth Avenue in case I had to put it down. And I was going to put it down there. Well, as it turned out, I managed to get around and up around the hill at Boniface on the back side of it, below the hill, and staggered on across the inlet. And pretty soon they were only supposed to put fuel in the two forward tanks in the Beaver in those days. Well, they'd filled all three tanks, and I got up to about, I may have been around 1,500 feet when I ran out of gas on the rear tank. And when the engine quit, the tail went like this. Went down. Well, I got the engine going again, and we proceeded on to Seward. Well, I get into Seward, and they start unloading the airplane. And the last thing on the floor of the airplane was 9 cat rollers at 120 pounds apiece. Plus, I had 500 pounds of sugar, and I don't know what else was in that airplane, but I was probably 1,000 to 1,500 pounds over gross when I took off. You know, and like I said, I was a lot younger then, and a lot dumber. So anyway, we got everything handled, and we made, I made 156 trips into Seward. And on one of the trips, I'd gone down through Resurrection Pass, and it was late in the evening, it was starting to get dark. And I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for a seatbelt. Because I left Seward, and it was snowing pretty hard through Resurrection Pass when I come through, and it was, like I said, it was getting dark, and I was about half asleep. All of a sudden, over the radio comes, "Anybody in there?" And like I say, if I hadn't had a seatbelt on, I'd have jumped out of the airplane. But those are just some of the things we did in those days.
Next up, Bill English, who was recently added to the Aviation Museum's Hall of Fame.
I'm so grateful to aviation because it opened up the world to me, ladies and gentlemen. And let me explain. I was born north of the Arctic Circle and at Coldfoot. And I flew in an airplane before I ever saw a train or a car or a train. And I think that planted the seed of desire in me at that time to fly. I've been very fortunate in having friends to help me along the way. I started flying a two-placer commercially for Wien with only a little over 200 hours. At that time, pilots in Alaska were brought in from the outside and had to have at least 1,500 hours. So hiring a pilot who just got his commercial was a big risk for them. And I could only fly the mail for the first few months, but they gradually moved me along to larger aircraft. And I spent two or three years flying the bush here. But let me fast forward to the later years of my flying. Ron Sheardown introduced me to private jet flying. And we flew around the world together at about the same latitude, from Fairbanks over to Europe, to Russia, and back into Alaska. And after that, I flew that same Lockheed Jetstar into Kuwait City after the Gulf War, which was, to me, a very interesting trip. Of course, flying across the ocean to London and down into Italy, and then across to the desert country. We flew over Syria. And I only mention this because Syria is in the headlines today. But the Syrian ground people that we talked to were the clearest and the most polite people that we had to deal with. Whereas when we flew over Paris, the French don't like to speak English, and they only speak English to the aircraft because they have to. But they put such a French accent on it that they're very hard to understand. And so we'd have to ask them to repeat several times in order to get the message they're trying to deliver to us. Okay, back to Kuwait City. When we flew into Kuwait City, Saddam Hussein had fired all oil derricks in the desert, every one in Kuwait. It literally covered with smoke. And when we landed at Kuwait City, I went out and ran my hand along the wings, and it was covered with oil. It was really something. We stayed in a hotel that had been bombed by the Iraqis. The top floor had been bombed. And the dining room was still there. And the Kuwaitis, of course, only the men used the dining room, and they were well fed. And we ate along with them. Not a one of them would weigh under 200 pounds, I think. And I don't think they had to do a day's work. But they were very friendly. I spent as much time looking around as I could. Went down to the shore where Iraqi boats were coming over from Iran to bring fresh supplies for Kuwait. they didn't have to go through customs or any kind of sign-ins. So a group of us walked down to where the boats were and watched them unload. And I finally started talking to one of the Iranians on the boats that could speak English. Interesting talk. And I finally asked him if he would take me over to Iran. And he said, sure, yeah. And he said, would you bring me back? And they all laughed. So anyway, following that, we took a trip through the burning desert where hundreds of oil wells were on fire. There wasn't a living thing there, and it was so hot that you couldn't get out of the car that we were in. And of course, the desert has depressions, and the oil would collect, and there were burning lakes of oil all going to waste. It was a terrible thing that Saddam Hussein did when he left Kuwait. But that trip, to me, I think was one of the most interesting trips in my lifetime. I had to retire from scheduled air carrier flying in 83, and Ron, when did I start?
It was 91.
91?
90 or 91.
And so it was in 92 when I was in Kuwait. Right. Well, as I began, the aviation community has been very good to me, and I've had a lot of help along the way, and you're being very good to me. Thank you very much.
And our last speaker is Ron Sheardown.
Good, thank you. My orders tonight from Sherry was to talk about the Goche search that took place in 1967 in the Canadian Arctic. I was flying on one of our mining operations, and there'd been an aircraft missing in the area for a couple of months, and we just happened to be delayed one day, and it was late in the afternoon, and got a sun flash off something and several miles away. And we had been searching for this airplane, and so we turned, and I think we were like 7 or 8 miles away, and sort of to the direction of where we saw the sun flash. And this airplane was sitting there, and the pilot was out walking around. And he'd been sitting there. He went down the 2nd of February, 1967, and we picked him up the 1st of April. And I think it was probably one of the longest survivals in the Canadian Arctic. And anyway, he just died last year, so he got an extra 40 years out of life. But the search had ended 6 weeks before. Would have probably another month or two, the aircraft would have melted through the ice, and probably nobody would have ever found out what happened. But the airplane was in good shape. He had used all the gas that he had left. He was in a storm, landed like Chuck did, and used what gas he had left in the airplane to cook, and used all his hydraulic fluid, engine oil, to cook with. Fortunately, when he left Cambridge Bay, he bought 150 pounds of Arctic char, and he quit eating fish after that. And anyway, he lost about 80 pounds. I told him he was in better shape when we picked him up than when he went down, because he was overweight when he landed. So, but anyway, he got many good years after that. And many of you may have seen ICE pilots, the current program in the Canadian Arctic, with the C-46 and other airplanes, Buffalo Airways. When he got back on his feet, he was the founder of Buffalo Airways and that program. he was a good survivor. And there's several other searches that I've been involved in over the years. One was an aircraft, a Beaver, that in Nongava, which is eastern Canada, northern Quebec, near Baffin Island. A Beaver was going across the peninsula, and he had missed where he was going to in bad weather, and continued for about 300 miles, and we found him after about 4 or 5 days of searching, and everybody was okay on that one. Another search was in 1976 in the Nome area. Excuse me. There was a what they call at that time was the, they call it now the Iron Dog, but at that time it was called the Top of the World 500. It was a snow machine race from Fairbanks to Nome, and there was quite a bad storm, and several of the teams got stuck in very bad weather, and we were able to pick up, I think it was eight people, and we lost one. One died, but eight people survived on that one. And so anyway, I started flying in 1953, just got through my 60 years, and started in eastern Canada. My first job was flying in northern British Columbia and the Yukon in 1954-55. And then the Dew Line construction started, and I flew through the Dew Line construction in Greenland and and eastern Canada. And I've run into a number of pilots that flew on the western Dew Line, and I was on the eastern Dew Line. But in 1967, we were studying ice conditions off the north coast of Alaska to look at shipping mining concentrates out of the Canadian Arctic to Japan and Asia. And the first place I ever landed in Alaska was Point Barrow. And my second landing was Prudhoe Bay when they were drilling the second well at Prudhoe Bay. And I thought after Greenland and the Canadian Arctic, I thought I'd arrived in the tropics. Good. Any questions?
Tell them where your AN2 is.
The AN2 is in the bottom of the ocean at the North Pole, the real North Pole. And we have a gentleman here tonight that can substantiate that. Walt Parker was with me when we went through the ice at the North Pole in, let's see, that was 2000. And unfortunately, we left the airplane there, but we did put the American flag, which was in the airplane, at the bottom of the ocean at the North Pole, considerable before the Russians claimed they planted a flag there. Anyway, we got in from Arizona last night, and I thought I'd landed back in Arizona looking at this weather. Yeah, good. Thank you.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Alaska pilots Dick Reeve, Chuck Cicera, Warren Polsky, Bill English, and Ron Sheerdown. The Old and Bold storytelling event was jointly hosted by the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum and Alaska Public Media. This talk was recorded on May 14th. Thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Beatty Trantina. Thank you for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.